From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and we're like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. Lil's sitting across the room from me. Phil's sitting in the next room.
Hey.
And Sydney is in there, but she can't hear me because she's not got a headset on. Have Sydney say hi, Phil.
Sid, say hi.
Hi.
Okay. And we will be your hosts as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 42 of Little Brother, dated the 20th of April, 2002. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. And before we get started, I need to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the WRPI staff or management, or the Rensselaer Student Union. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for rebuttal. If you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so. I told you last week, you guys are already paid up. You don't have to do that. You can call us at area code 518. See, now I forgot the phone number. 518-276-6248. That number again, 518-276-6248. Also, you can send an email. The email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That address again is critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. Gesundheit. Was that a sneeze?
That wasn't me.
Yeah. It was somebody else in the CD room.
There's someone else in here with us.
Oh, okay, yeah. I think.
God
there
bless
he is.
You.
And I lost track of where I was again.
I don't know. You gave out the phone number. You were talking about
number,
your email.
Gave out the email address.
C-R-I-T-T-E-R
at VerizonEatsPoop, all one word, .com.
You do realize before the show started, you were playing that that plug for that concert that happened yesterday.
Oops. Well, now I feel real stupid.
Well, you filled the airtime you were supposed to fill with ads, so there
Third
you are.
Concert Friday, April 19th. Yep, sure enough.
I'll be danged. You know, just that's a shame because I kind of wanted to go.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. I'm personally very supportive of the people of Vieques and their fight to get the bombing to stop. And I just realized I haven't got the delay on, so we'll just kick that in.
I just wanted to hear the Latin music.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Just realized I haven't got the delay on, so we'll just kick that in.
I just wanted to hear the Latin music.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we do have a CD of it, so maybe we'll play some a little bit later on in the show during one of the breaks. Oh, at any rate, last but not least, the address is... if you want to send snail mail, send it to Chuck Ritter, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Box 31, Troy, New York, 12180. And that'll get it to me. I suppose, as usual, we could start with a few items from the Risks Digest. First item that I have from the latest Risks Digest was submitted by Jeremy Epstein. He says that 3 of the 12 largest banks in Japan recently merged, and the results weren't pretty, including more than 30,000 transaction errors, and 2.5 million delayed debits, and 2.5 million of the 3 million automatic debits scheduled to be processed on 1st of April 2002, including utility and credit card bills, couldn't be made on that day. The problem was that each of the banks ran a different system, one a Hitachi, one an IBM, and one a Fujitsu, although no software was actually mentioned. They built some integration glue, but it didn't work. Let's see. We have another one that was submitted by somebody who just identifies himself as Ishikawa. He says, this news seems to be reported over foreign wire services, and so many have been reported already, but here it goes anyway. Japan's Mizuho Financial Group that operates Mizuho Bank has been born out of the merger of 3 large banks. This would be the same one. Daiichi, Kangyo, and Nihon Kogyo Bank, and Fuji Bank. It started its merged new operations on 1st of April 2002. There was also another holding bank, but the Mizuho Bank is the one where ordinary people have accounts carried over from the three banks. Since that day, the online banking transaction systems of the new banks has been plagued with problems. On the 1st of April, the ATMs malfunctioned, and many users of the new bank could not withdraw or deposit money. That continued until the next day. Now, I thought this was a labor pain often found in the new operation, but no, the problem persisted, and the cause seemed to run much deeper than I originally thought. Now, for the last few days, the online banking transactions for payments of utility bills such as gas, electricity, water, and credit company payments are delayed heavily due to problems of unknown cause. This morning's Asahi Shimbun newspaper, Yokohama edition, carried a top article that stated the management of Mizuho FG admitted the backlog of transactions amounts to more than $2.5 million. About 3 million such payments expected to take place on the 1st of April could not be finished on time, and 105,000 transactions remain unfinished even as of April 5th. The delay affected the subsequent processing of other transactions, and the unfinished count exceeded $2.5 million on April 5th. The fifth day of each month is the payment day of the credit card companies, and thus there were many transactions to take place that day. About 30,000 incorrect double withdrawals and about 5,000 double deposits were found and corrected. Not all of them, it seems, according to the NHK News just presented. According to the bank, the current accumulation of delayed transactions would need the whole of next week to finish. That would have been, of course, this week. The completion notification of utility bills payments to utility companies is also delayed very much. Such delayed notices are believed to be more than 5 million cases. It seems as if the bank doesn't exactly know the status of the payment. The bank management admitted that although they've tested the integrated online transaction system many times before the complete merger and the start of operation on April 1st, their expectation of the workload was not accurate enough. And Ishikawa takes credit for all of the translation in this. Seems like a pretty good translation to me, actually.
It all made sense to me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What do you have there? Anything interesting?
Oh, this top one is one that kind of caught my eye right off. Arlington bait car hooks suspect.
Oh, I like this one.
This is a neat one.
This was out of the Wired, Wired.com.
It says WashingtonPost.com.
Oh, it was Washington Post?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I looked too quick, I guess.
Jose Gonzalez was charged by Arlington police over the weekend with auto theft. He had no clue it was the car that turned him in. The late model sedan he was driving was the Arlington County Police Department's new bait car, wired to alert police when someone tries to steal it. When the car called police, a map of Arlington, it's just so funny, the car called the police.
Yeah.
A map of Arlington flashed on a computer screen in the Emergency Communications Center, pinpointing the vehicle's location. Because the car was linked to a global positioning device, dispatchers tracked its movements on the computer screen and knew where to send two police cars. This is an exciting marriage of technology and classical crime control, Police Chief Edward A. Flynn said yesterday. For once, a new gizmo helps us catch a bad guy in the act. Gonzalez's arrest marked the first of its kind in the Washington region, with a stolen vehicle, in effect, playing the role of snitch. Arlington police hope their new fleet of bait cars will cut down on auto theft, and other police departments, including Price Williams's, are planning to test drive some of their own soon. Is that Prince? Oh,
driven.
Prince Williams. Oh, Prince Williams Police Department? What? I don't know.
It's the name of, I believe it's the name of a county in Virginia.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. I don't know that Virginia geography. Arlington Detective Chris D'Angelis was intrigued by the success of bait cars in Minneapolis, which has had a decline in auto theft. We believe it's making a difference, said Minneapolis investigator Wayne Johnson, who's fielding phone calls from law enforcement agencies across the country. D'Angelis said police parked their first bait car in Arlington on February 8th, selecting from among the most commonly stolen vehicles. Nationally, that list includes Toyota Camrys, Honda Accords, and Oldsmobile Cutlasses. They doctored it with just the right amount of trash or car stuff to make it look like it belonged there. The technology inside the car costs about $3,000, about the same price as the extra computer equipment at the communications center, he said. Finally, just after midnight Saturday, the bait car made its first call. Textbook, D'Angelis said yesterday. It was beautiful. It requires no babysitting. Once police decide where to park the cars, they don't have to stick around. The technology, produced by Ontario-based HGI Wireless Incorporated, allows the car to let them know when a car thief has been at the wheel. The car called us. I'm being stolen, Lieutenant Elaine Moore, who supervises the police department's auto theft unit, said of the bugle noise that sounded on the computer. Police work has evolved to keep up with the criminals. Yeah, for the moment. Police won't say what inside the car triggers the alert. But when officers closed in on the astonished suspect minutes after the car was stolen, they also had the technology to disable the vehicle, stopping it in its tracks. Ooh,
what
that's
causes
handy.
The what causes what inside the car causes the alert? Maybe it might be something like the engine starting.
Yeah.
Or the wheels turning or some other stupid thing like
some
that.
Some silly thing, yeah. Some silly thing that indicates the car is moving, although it should not be. Flynn said that capability ensures that the suspect won't see police in the rearview mirror and race off, endangering lives. Arlington Commonwealth's attorney Richard E. Trodden hopes the bait cars will be an effective tool in fighting a persistent problem. Last year, 702 auto thefts were recorded, down from more than 1,000 a year over the past decade. He does not anticipate any successful challenges from defense attorneys that the tactic is entrapment. Entrapment is where the government plants the seed of a crime in the mind of an individual who would not otherwise be criminally inclined, Trodden says. We don't want that. But if we had somebody who was out there ready to steal something, it's good police work. In addition to facing a grand larceny auto charge, Gonzalez, 40, was charged with possessing burglary tools and driving on a suspended license. Ooh, that's good. Steal a car, drive without a license. That's good. That's smart.
Brilliant.
Arlington police won't say what kind of vehicle he was driving or where they plan to park their big cars next. But Alexandria police spokeswoman Amy Birch has a suggestion. If they want to park it in Alexandria, that would be fine with us, she said.
I have two comments here. One comment, of course, would be I would think after a while word would get out about a description of the particular bait car. You know, I mean, you already have a partial description right there. It's a Toyota Camry. We know that.
Well, or if one of two or three different others they had.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is you'd kind of want to make sure that if a car gets parked that it. Oh, Phil's mic is not working. Why is Phil's mic not working?
I don't know. You tested it. You could tell me. I feel like we're kids again. I don't know. You tested it.
Try it now.
Wow.
Okay. I don't know what's going on in there. Why that's not working.
I'll have to fix it. Take a break and fix it or something.
Yeah, or something like that. Well, No, forget it, Phil. It just doesn't want to come
to
life.
Beating it around. That's bizarre, too, because it was on not that long ago.
Yeah, exactly.
The change.
Exactly. I don't get it. Well, at least could try doing that. How about that?
Does that work? Phil.
Oh, he's got his headset off.
Phil.
Is
try
it working
it now,
out?
Phil.
Nope.
No.
Okay. All right. We'll try to solve that offline, I guess. I can tell it's going to be one of those days.
It's been one of those days.
It's starting to be one of those days.
What I was going to say is that if you want to be safe, you just buy a Toyota Camry if you live in that area. And your car probably won't get stolen.
Well, the other thing I was going to say is if somebody parks a car and then walks down the street rather than walking into a building, chances are that if somebody noticed this fact, of course you'd have to have been there when the car got parked, but if somebody happened to notice this fact, or if a car has been parked someplace for an inordinately long time, it might be a bad choice. I don't know. Those are just a couple of thoughts. I'm sure that the police have already thought of these things, too, and figured out what to do about it. Well, obviously, we have to work out a couple of minor technical issues here. So what I'm going to do right now is, since Lil had expressed an interest in hearing some Latin music, I'm going to throw on the CD that we have here, of Mundo Nuevo. That would be the band that was playing yesterday on the benefit for Vieques.
The band that we missed, that we advertised?
Yeah.
Today?
That's the one.
For the concert yesterday.
So let's hear that, and then we'll come back in a minute. You're listening to Little Brother on WRPI Troy. Thank you.
que callada manera se me adentra usted sonriendo, como si fuera la primavera y yo muriendo. Y de qué modo sutil me derramó en la camisa todas las flores de abril. ¿Quién le dijo que yo era risa siempre, nunca llanto? Como si fuera la primavera y no soy tanto. Y en cambio qué espiritual que usted me vende una rosa, de su rosa el principal. ¿De qué callada manera se me adentra usted sonriendo? Como si fuera la primavera, ahí yo muriendo, yo muriendo. ¿Quién le dijo que yo era risa siempre, nunca llanto? Como si fuera la primavera y no soy tanto. Y en cambio que espiritual que usted me brinde una rosa, de su rosa el principal. De qué callada manera se me adentra usted sonriendo, como si fuera la primavera, ay, yo muriendo, yo muriendo.
And you're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI Troy. The show is a little brother. We've solved our little technological problems.
The low-tech way.
The low-tech way. We moved
we
Fel
brought
in,
them in here.
Moved Fel and Sydney into the main studio here. Now we can hear them when they talk. And Fel was a little bit puzzled by the choice of music. But the idea was we did have an announcement at the start of the... What?
What? No, it's the snack
the veggie
that,
booty.
Oh my God. Have you seen these? He got them at the health food store. They're awful. They're absolutely awful.
With kale.
Oh my God. It says veggie booty with spinach and kale.
Arr.
Veggie booty puts you in the mindset to eat healthier and change your life. Take it on a train or in your car, on a walk or on a boat. Veggie booty will be your good friend.
Arr, toss your cookies with veggie booty.
That's a lot. So to ask for it, it has a little pirate on it. It says, crunchy, good provisions, shiver me timbers. It's the nastiest thing I've ever eaten.
Yeah,
it smells like chicken feed and it tastes like rotten broccoli.
I think Sydney wanted to say
but
something
it crunches.
Also here.
Yuck.
Yeah, it tastes like you ever feed a fish, you ever feed a goldfish those little flakes?
Yeah.
You know how they smell? That's what this tastes like.
Did you try them, Sydney?
Yes, she did.
Oh,
Phil
boy.
Said she could go to the carnival on Friday if she ate one, and she ate one.
Yuck, yuck.
Yeah, they were like she was making faces I've never seen before.
You know, I'll tell you something. I heard about a conversation between a health food nut and somebody who was not. And the health food nut said, pointed at the other guy's hamburger, said, "You know, that's going to kill you." And the guy eating the hamburger pointed back at the at whatever the health food nut was eating, and he says, "You're already dead."
Hmm.
I don't know. Anyway, as I was saying, we did get a phone call during the break thanking us for looking out for the Latin community in our community,
oh.
The Latin subcommunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the way I guess
even if we were a day late and more than a dollar short, but hey.
I don't care. My support for the people of Vieques stands, you know. I do not approve of the military activity going on down there. At any rate, it looks like Sydney wants to put another word in, so we'll let her do that.
What word will it be this time? What's the word?
When I was a baby, my first word was clock.
Her first word was clock, huh?
Indeed. She was fascinated by them.
I remember your first sentence.
Yes, I remember my first sentence, too.
Yeah, we haven't let you forget it, have
yeah,
we?
Yeah, as I remember, as I recall, I was telling Dad off was my first sentence. I was like,
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. It wasn't quite as bad as all that.
I don't know. It had the effect I must have wanted. So he sat down, he shut up, and he ate his eggs.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. So back on topic here. We've got some more items out of the Risks Digest, so we could move on to those. Except Sydney has something else she wants to say.
Which is what?
I love my mommy.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yes, it is.
So back on topic.
I love my computer.
I don't have that song with me tonight.
No.
I played it yesterday. Yeah. Let's see here. New scan submitted to the Risks Digest that 85% of the respondents to a survey report having been victims of computer crime costing them millions of dollars, according to a survey by the Computer Security Institute and the FBI.
Hey, does that mean that each person was cost millions of dollars, or as a group they lost millions of dollars?
I'm assuming that it means that it was as a group.
Mm.
The study, which polled 583 computer security experts in business, government agencies, medical institutions, and universities, concluded that the most serious losses stemmed from the theft of property. Of proprietary information. In addition, almost all of the organizations had suffered from computer virus attacks last year, and the organizations had, I read that line, and 90% said they had been victims of website defacement in 2001, up from 64% a year earlier. Organizations that want to survive in the coming years need to develop a comprehensive approach to information security, embracing both the human and technical dimensions, says Patrice Rapolis, the director of the Computer Security Institute. In response to the growing threat of cybercrime, I really hate that word. I'm going to edit that, actually. In response to the growing threat of computer-based crime, the FBI has set up the National Infrastructure Protection Center and has formed regional computing intrusion squads in several offices throughout the U.S. This apparently was picked up from the BBC Online. Another item also sent to us from NewsScan says one proposal for improving airport security has been the creation of hard-to-counterfeit trusted traveler ID cards for frequent travelers. But software developer Richard P. Eastman asks the obvious question, what makes a trusted traveler? The guy who travels all the time, who travels on business, who has a reason to travel. Does that mean the terrorist can't penetrate that group? Of course he can. Beyond the objections of that sort, civil libertarians have been arguing that ID cards for travelers will set a dangerous precedent. Barry S. Steinhardt of the American Civil Liberties Union predicts, quickly enough, policymakers are going to say, if this works, let's require everyone to go through the background checks before they get on a plane. And that was brought to us via news scan from the New York Times. You find anything else interesting over there?
Yeah, I don't know how... I know this sounds kind of like a check out this newfangled thing, but I'm gonna read this story.
Oh, is that
anyway.
the story about Vonage? About the telephone over IP?
Yeah.
Looking at that and thinking that's pretty cool.
It's from time.com, but it says on the internet talk is cheap. When I told a friend I was making phone calls over the internet, he chuckled urbanely, sat me down in a comfy chair, and gently explained that no, you get the internet over your phone, not the other way round, and for God's sake, would I please try to pull myself together? He was wrong, of course. Internet phone service is very real, and newfangled as it sounds, see there's that word, it has one very old-fashioned American virtue, it's cheap. Since when is cheapness an American virtue?
Well, we tend to think short-term enough that we will buy something cheap instead of buying something quality, even though it means that despite the fact that the quality item cost 50% more, over the length of time that the quality item would have lasted, we will buy three of the cheapies.
Okay, wait, so how's that a virtue?
It's a virtue because we're so cheap that we look at the bottom line first.
The bottom line
first. The first bottom line we see.
We're excellent mathematicians, us Americans, apparently. It's not even that newfangled. Companies like Netaphone and Dialpad have been selling internet phone service for years. But it hasn't caught on for a variety of reasons. It can be tricky to use, some services require exotic hardware, and the audio quality is iffy at best. Most internet phone calls sound like they're coming from a broken payphone on Mars. But that's changing. There's a new technology called Session Initiation Protocol that handles internet phone calls more efficiently, making them less expensive and more hi-fi. Last week, I decided to give it a chance. I signed up for a new internet phone service called Vonage, which costs $40 a month for unlimited local and long-distance calling, plus a one-time $25 setup fee. How is that better than just getting a regular phone? $40 a month.
Because that $40 a month gives you absolutely...
Oh, unlimited, says, yeah.
Unlimited long-distance calls.
Yes, but the thing is, what about an incoming number? Do you get an incoming number?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Ooh, well, then that's new.
That would be...
And you get to pick the
area code.
Yes, but
that's only if we made $40 worth of calls that would make up for it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Sid, you want to say something?
Oh, she forgot. Okay. The average American phone bill is $55, so that's a pretty good deal, even factoring in the cost of a broadband internet connection, which is required. You sign up online at www.vonage.com. That's V-O-N-A-G-E, by the way, for the curious. And they send you a sinister-looking box the size of a large ashtray. Well, that's just the word Phil needed to hear. Hook your cable modem or DSL line up to one end of the box. Plug any ordinary phone into the other end, and you're ready to go. No PC required. If you want to share your connection with a PC, as most people will, you'll need to run it through a router. Vonage will sell you one for $25. The setup is a little more involved, but it's still not brain surgery. So you have to have a router and this little black box that they send you.
Well, yeah, but if you've already got a router and you've already got a computer and you've already got, then all you need is this little black box.
Sure, and I know Phil's been looking for an excuse to get a router, so
yeah.
I'm sure he'll will be on board.
Yeah, I want a router.
So that'll be the next thing.
Unfortunately, I was looking it over, and I actually did check into the details on the service, and unfortunately, 518 is not one of the area codes they offer. That doesn't mean you don't get service here. It just means you'll end up with a number somewhere downstate, 914.
So other people will have to call you long distance.
Basically, yeah.
That sucks for them.
Yeah, well, actually, I'll tell you, though, the thing of it is that the model of charging money for a long distance call is getting kind of outdated. Because
it no longer costs any more to send it long distance than it does to send it local.
Right. Well, it does to the company, sure, but to the consumer, only the wireline phone companies still charge anything for long distance. I mean, you've got Vonage there offering it for a flat rate, and most of the cellular providers are offering it for a flat rate. They take it out of your minutes, and it's just like making a local call.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, listen, we are up at the top of the hour. And that leads me to the point where I have to say WRPI Troy. And having said that, I need to take a few minutes to do a little bit of paperwork. And while I'm doing the paperwork, we'll listen to another tune from Mundo Nuevo. Mundo, did I say that right? Yes, I did.
I don't know.
And this song is called El Cuarto de Tula.
He probably didn't say that right.
I'm sure I said that part right because I wrote that one down.
Phonetically represented or...
He knew Spanish.
A little bit. All right, here we go.
Para. fueron los bomberos con sus campanas, sus sirenas. Allá fueron los bomberos con sus campanas, sus sirenas. Ay, mamá, ¿qué pasó? Ay, mamá, ¿qué pasó? El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela. Se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela. El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela. Se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela. Que ya tuve. El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela. Se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela.
Tula prende velas buscando amor, buscando fortuna, que ya tuve.
El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela, se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela. Pabara, 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 pabara. Le cogió candela, se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela.
Con una manguera el bombero llegó, pero el cuarto de Tula nunca se apagó. Que ya tuve.
El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela, se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela.
Una vela roja a Chaco le prendió, y el cuarto de Tula también se incendió.
El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela, se quedó dormida y no apagó la vela. El cuarto de Tula le cogió candela, se quedó dormida y no apagó la
give free will. What happens if you are judged not to have believed in Jesus, not to have believed in his teaching? What then happens to you? If you don't obey God's word, then you go to hell.
You know, it's...
Come on, sir. Come on. Come on down. Down. Come on down the aisle, brother. Really.
He said if we choose to believe in him and his ways and his... That's all we have to...
Wait. Hold your point, please. Hold your point. But wait, please. Because you're almost there. You almost see the ridiculousness of your position. God is a vicious SOB.
How
stupid can you be? God is a vicious SOB.
How stupid can you be?
God is a vicious SOB.
How stupid can you be?
God is a vicious SOB.
How stupid can you be?
One of the most violent baby abusers. And now you understand why when you say... Ray, you know, God gave us free will. It's as though, sir, you walked into your neighbor's house,
but Ray,
and you pulled a gun on the beautiful wife,
but Ray,
and you said, give me a blowjob.
But Ray,
and she says, no, I'm not going to have sex with you. That is ridiculous. Now, I'm giving you a choice.
But Ray,
you either give me sex,
but Ray,
or I'm going to blow your damn brains out.
But Ray.
Or I'm going to blow your damn brains out.
But Ray.
And what are you going to do when you are arrested, sir?
But Ray.
Are you going to stand before a court and say, no, Your Honor, I gave her a choice.
But Ray.
I told her, you have a free choice here.
But Ray.
You either choose to have sex with me.
But Ray.
Or I'm going to blow your brains out.
But Ray.
I blew her brains out.
But Ray. But Ray.
Sir, don't you see how foolish you sound?
But Ray.
Give me sex.
But Ray.
Give me a blowjob. I blew her brains out.
But Ray.
Give me sex.
But Ray.
Give me a blowjob. I blew her brains out.
But Ray.
I mean, isn't the judge going to say, but you had a gun to her head?
But Ray.
And so therefore, sir, no choice was rendered.
But that raid.
No choice was rendered, right?
Hold on.
Listen, let me put you on hold so I can take care of some business.
And you're listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. Another track from the Droplift Project. We told you about the Droplift Project last week. And that was Phineas Narco and Ronard Redball with a tune called Free Will. At any rate, it comes to that part in the show now where we need to stop a second and tell you what's going on in the Capital District after dark. Let's see. And you know what? I did it again. I picked out a sheet with stuff on it, and every single one of them has already passed. So we're just going to get rid of that guy.
Hey, my mic's not on. There we go. Going, mundo nuevo, and no one could hear.
Okay. All right.
It's obviously going to be one
of those nights.
So tonight, go out somewhere and do some things, and now we've covered the
nightlife. Tonight after dark, you'll notice people are just hanging out in the corner.
Feel free to call the police on them.
Okay, sure. We have a couple items here. This is things that are going on at the Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton, Massachusetts. For information, you can call 413-586-2632. Tonight at 7 o'clock, right after this show, is Relative Strangers. Also tonight, I don't know how they're... Oh, I see. They're stacking them up. Also tonight at 9:30 is Barry Kingston and the Screaming Souls. On Monday the 22nd, the Fairport Convention at 7 p.m. On Tuesday the 23rd, Lake Trout plus Cancer Conspiracy at 8:30. Let's see, Wednesday the 24th, John Stewart at 7 p.m.
John Stewart? Like from The Daily Show, John Stewart?
It says John Stewart.
Wait, where
is that? It's spelled exactly the same. It's at the Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton, Massachusetts.
Ooh.
So,
I mean, well, how many different ways are there to spell John Stewart, really?
Just a couple. There's a few. I can think of four permutations right off the top of my head, but you just don't know.
You can also think of the word permutations off the top of your head, which is just not right.
Your point is taken.
So, yeah. No, that's very exciting. Wait, what night was that?
That was Wednesday the 24th at 7 p.m.
That's no good.
You know, give him a call and find out if it's that John Stewart.
Even if it is, I'm not driving out to Massachusetts by 7 o'clock on Wednesday night. It's just not going to happen.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Well, in case somebody does, it's 413-586-2632. These are all things going on at the Iron Horse Music Hall. And I'll just go up a couple more here so that we bring it up to next Saturday. And then I'll take it from there next Saturday. On Thursday, the 25th, Greg Brown and Jeff Lang at 7 and 9:30. And on the 26th, that's Friday, Stephen Killog plus Deb Tellen at 7 p.m. And all of these shows, like I said, are at the Iron Horse Music Hall in Northampton, Massachusetts. So if any of them interest you, get on out there and support your local musicians. Okay, I think we've said all there is to be said about that. Last week, we discussed, or tried to discuss, this new...
Fully?
I don't think we fully discussed anything last week.
No, we did, except for Foley. That we discussed pretty thoroughly. Because I didn't know what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
So somebody had to say what it was.
Yeah,
hold on just a second. What?
I love you.
I love you too, Sid.
She loves Chuck. So... that was the only thing we discussed thoroughly at all with Foley and the making thereof.
Anyway, one of the things we did attempt to discuss was this idea, this boneheaded idea that BMW, I believe it was, had.
Oh, yes.
The knob to that controls everything in the car.
Yeah, I actually got to use that as small talk at a party later.
I've talked about this thing probably 5-6 times since.
It's just such an astonishingly stupid idea.
Uh-huh, exactly.
So obviously a bad idea.
Well, we have a couple of follow-up items on this one here. These are all items that were followed up by posting to the Risks Digest. Devin McCormick wrote this one. He says, an example of the risk of simplifying an interface. While on vacation recently, I rented a new model car. One reason I rented it was to take my daughter to a drive-in movie, since these are rapidly disappearing and I wanted her to have this experience. Well, this drive-in in Tucson, Arizona, does not have the speakers that you attach to your car window. Instead, you tune your radio to a specified FM channel to get the sound for the movie. And of course, you know exactly how this works. We've got one of those right down the street from where
several.
We grew up.
Yeah. But there's tons of them just even in this area.
But to carry on, as I started up the car to drive to the movie that night, I noticed that the headlights came on by themselves, presumably because it was dark. We got to the movie and parked, found the radio station with the movie soundtrack, and discovered there was absolutely no way to turn off the headlights while keeping the power on to the radio. One can imagine the overly clever engineer thinking, now, why would anybody want to sit in a car with the lights off and the power on?
I don't know. Obviously, they've never been to Makeout Point.
That's the immediate thing that came to my mind when I heard that. Whereas some of us should come up with at least a couple of reasons for doing this. Evidently, Detroit isn't that imaginative. Evidently, Detroit is not terribly romantic either.
Well, have you seen Detroit?
I passed through their airport once, twice. That's about it. That's about all I've seen of Detroit. That's about as much as I've seen of Atlanta. That's about as much as I've seen of several cities, unfortunately.
And several countries, like, you know.
Yeah, like Osaka, Japan. I gotta give credit to Osaka. Kansai Airport is cool. It's the only time I have ever been in an airport that everything actually ran smoothly. Most of the flights were not showing a sign saying delayed. If they said anything but on time, they said early, which was wild, in my opinion. But anyway, let me see here. I don't know if I want to take that one on. Do you have one there that looks juicy?
What is this? Oh, this is about a free library. It says Jim Bain and I set up the free library about a year and a half ago.
Okay, yeah, we got to definitely give credit on this one before you get started on that one. That's a long one,
www.bain.com. What do you mean give credit? Oh, Eric Flint, who wrote it?
Yeah, exactly. It's because this one's more of an editorial, really, than anything solid, and it is quite lengthy, so probably just want to read the first
page,
few paragraphs of it, yeah.
Leaving aside various political and philosophical issues, which I've addressed elsewhere, the premise behind the library had a practical component as well. In brief, that in relative terms, an author will gain, not lose, by having titles in the library. What I mean by relative is simply this. Overall, an author is far more likely to increase sales than to lose them. Or, to put it more accurately, exposure in the library will generate more sales than it will lose. As a practical proposition, the theory behind the free library is that, certainly in the long run, it benefits an author to have a certain number of free or cheap titles of theirs readily available to the public. By far, the main enemy any author faces, except a handful of ones who are famous to the public at large, is simply obscurity. Even well-known sci-fi authors are only read by a small percentage of the potential sci-fi audience. Most readers, even ones who have heard of the author, simply pass them up. Why? In most cases, simply because they don't really know anything about the writer and aren't willing to spend $7 to $28 just to experiment. So they keep buying those authors they're familiar with. What the free library provides, as do traditional libraries, or simply the old familiar phenomenon of friends lending each other books, is a way for people to investigate a new author for free before they plunk down any money. That was the premise behind the free library when I first set it up. At the time, since I had no experience to go by, I was basing that on common sense as well as Jim Bain's experience judgment as a longtime publisher. Now, with a year and a half's experience of the library actually established and running, our original assessment has been demonstrated in practice. The library's track record shows clearly that the traditional encryption/enforcement policy, which has been followed thus far by most of the publishing industry, is just plain stupid, as well as unconscionable from the viewpoint of infringing on personal liberties. The purpose of this essay is to demonstrate that based on facts. Let me begin by posing a simple question. Does anyone have any real evidence that having material available for free online, whether legitimately or through piracy, has actually caused any financial harm to any author? The entire argument for encryption rests precisely upon this presumption a presumption which has never once been documented or demonstrated, and which, to the contrary, has been cast into question any number of times. I'm about to cast it into question again. Here are a number of facts which you should consider. Number one, the first title to go up into the library was my own novel, Mother of Demons. Nice title. That was my first published novel, which came out in print in September of 1997. At the time it went into the free library in the fall of 2000, that novel had sold 6,000... Is someone on the phone?
No, not right now.
Oh, okay. 9,694 copies with a sell-through of 54%. As of today, according to Bain Books, a year and a half after being available for free online to anyone who wants it, no restrictions and no questions asked, Mother of Demons has sold about 18,500 copies and is now has a sell-through of 65%. I would like someone to explain to me how almost doubling the sales and improving the sell-through by 11% has caused me, as an author, any harm. The opposite is, in fact, the case. Mother of Demons began its life as a typical first novel, yeah, particularly in regards to the title, with very modest sales and sell-through.
Today, I'm sure that the title probably led to the particular sales pattern.
I don't know. Today, it has better than average sales and much better than average sell-through, a change that took place simultaneously with a book being available for free online. You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of the... You ever see that really, really, really bad sci-fi story, The Eye of Argon? You ever see that?
I would have to say that I have not.
It's fantastically atrocious. In fact, it's so bad that it was written at a college and submitted for a writing competition.
Right.
And it was awarded the dubious honor of being the... It was rated as the worst science fiction story of all time. That was the award that the guy won for submitting it. And it is atrocious. And somebody has actually written a script, Misty 3K-ing it all the way through. It's hysterical.
I'm looking for a movie I remember when I was a kid, and I can't find it now. It was called Crossover. It was about this psychotic computer that took over the city and was killing people.
You know,
that sounds awful.
That seems to be a really popular theme. I mean, just before I left the house this afternoon, there was a film on TV on the Sci-Fi Channel called Gunhead, which was on that same theme.
Right. Well, it's like, you know, computers aren't psychotic; programmers are. Well, some are. Sure.
you wouldn't know. We look like everybody else.
Computer programmers? No, you don't look like everybody else. No, you don't.
Okay, fine. Be that way. See if I care. Okay.
So, yeah, there's a whole lot more to the story, but I think I pretty much summed up.
Yeah, I think that
makes the point.
That makes the point, absolutely. And my hope is that the RIAA and the MPAA are listening, but of course, we know better.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. No. So, for those of you that are curious about that really, really atrocious sci-fi story, I actually found it through, I don't have the URL on me, but I found it through Cruel.com. So if you just go through Cruel's archives, you might find it.
Mm-hmm.
It was hysterical. I mean, I was almost wetting my pants reading it. It was absolutely hysterical.
I know that Eric Flint and Jim Bain are not the only ones to have established free libraries online either. There's one particular book that I really, really enjoyed, and I've recommended to a couple people through this program when they've called up and asked about it. It's called The Hacker Crackdown. It's by Bruce Sterling. It's a little bit dated at this point in time. It was written in somewhere around 1990 or so, but it is available entirely online as well as through your usual channels.
Yes, but will you wet your pants with laughter reading it?
No, you will not. However, you'll get kind of a feel for where I come from.
Yeah. Now that guy, it was like, I think it was Fongaboo used this phrase once, referring to somebody. The guy who wrote that book that I'm talking about from Cruel.com, it was like somebody took a thesaurus and put it on like shuffle, you know, and he just started like spitting out words. And they're all big words, but they don't all necessarily match with what he's actually talking about. And it's spectacular. It's a spectacular waste of verbiage.
Interesting. It's kind of like it's kind of like the film Matinee. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember the film, in the film, Mant?
Kind of, vaguely.
They showed little clips of this B-grade sci-fi film that the main film was about. And it was funny to hear just about anybody, not just about anybody, but when the scientist that was the mandatory character in the film, talk, it was funny to hear him talk because he paused and just about every sentence he spoke, he paused to insert some parenthetical remark to bring some small educational value to the movie. We have a call on the line, actually. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Already?
Yes, you are.
Well, you don't give a person a chance, do you?
If I'm in the middle of an article, I'll let it ride a little bit. But if I'm in the middle of freeforming it and ranting, then yeah, absolutely. I'll just bring in anybody that wants to talk. So welcome to the show.
That's charmingly playful of the two of you. I was just listening to you talking about the popular theme of computers taking over.
Yeah.
And I was linking that with the ongoing argument or discussion, I should say, about whether computers can ever approximate human consciousness. And you know, which is an underlying theme of that computer taking over.
Yeah, absolutely.
Issue. And it just occurred to me, I had a flash of insight, and I credit you with it.
Go for it.
Because there are other stories and films, as you, I'm sure you're well aware, on that same theme. And so on the basis of the axiom that I'm sure you're also aware of, that life imitates art.
Right.
So, you know, movies and books and so on are art forms, and this theme is showing up in art. It's just over and over again. So what I'm thinking is maybe there's actually more to it than we've realized. And my insight is this, that given mainstream American culture, the contours of it at this historical conjuncture are such that it really doesn't, in terms of what comes over the airwaves, the network TV for the most part, it doesn't involve interacting with the public in an emotional way, except in terms of very superficial emotions. It all appeals, in one way or another, simply to the intellect, which is the coldest, I think, part of our consciousness, and the part of our consciousness that most mimics what goes on inside of a computer, the unemotional, sort
the,
of the...
The logic of...
Yeah, right, yeah. The classic... you know, the definition of an intellectual is like a disembodied brain. You know, someone who looks at a problem without any emotional dimension, simply from an intellectual, logical, Dr. Spockian kind of a way. And I would argue that the establishment in this country is trying to pushes that kind of an approach. They don't really want us to care very, very deeply about anything except shopping. And therefore, it's entirely possible that the divide between computer intelligence and human intellectual activity, as it is at this stage in history, should be coming closer and closer together. You see what I mean?
Right, but not by the way that people think. People think that what's going to happen is computers are going to get better and better, when in fact people are becoming simpler and simpler.
What's the difference?
And I'm going to bring another point in here also. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second here and suggest that perhaps the establishment is not being absolutely coldly intellectual about it, because if somebody was absolutely, completely, coldly intellectual, then they wouldn't feel the emotion of greed, and consequently no logical need to drive everybody to just shop, shop, shop.
Yeah, I mean,
exploitation wouldn't be necessary.
I think you've raised an interesting glitch in my theory. However, I think it may be no more than a glitch, because I tried to cover that in my introduction when I said that the mainstream media applies to superficial and what the person who wrote the book about banning television called the hard emotions, the superficial ones that you can't sustain very long.
Sure.
So that a greedy person, you know, while the greed, you know, it's a part of their personality, it's very hard to call that. I mean, it is emotion in a way, but it's a twisted emotion. It's emotions that have become distorted, bent, perverted. So, I hesitate to include that in the category of things that I consider genuine, valid, desirable emotions. And, you know, I think it's entirely possible to program a computer to mimic greed, because at root, greed is cold calculation for the sake of accumulating material wealth. Right.
Well,
that's just like playing Monopoly. Well,
if anyone could do it, I'm sure Bill Gates could.
You know, the movie Citizen Kane, there's a great line by Everett Sloan early in the film, and he's talking about the lead character played by Orson Welles, and he's being interviewed by a reporter, and he said, you know, you were talking about Kane having made a lot of money, and Everett Sloan character said, you know, making a lot of money is not hard if all you want to do is make a lot of money.
Yeah.
In other words, if you are willing to devote all of your emotional energy, that is to subsume it beneath the calculations, the cold, ruthless calculations involved in the pursuit of material wealth, you will succeed. But emotions get in the way, and I think that was the character's point. If all you care about is making money, then you don't care about anything. You really don't have feeling in
right.
a true sense.
Right.
And that's really what our culture is about. And that's why I say that the human conscious I think your friend actually may have put her finger on it, that people are approaching computers faster than computers are approaching people.
Okay, that's probably true. Now I'm going to make another quick point too, and one thing that sci-fi never seems to address, or at least I've never seen it address it, is maybe it has. Is the implications? I don't talk about spirituality very much on my show, but there are spiritual implications, and I imagine that if mankind is ever able to create a machine mm-hmm. that equals another human being in intellect, that a lot of people are going to suffer from a spiritual shock. If not, and even for the non-spiritual, perhaps an ontological shock.
Oh, some people will. You know, I think you and your friend will, and some other people will, but not everyone. I mean, my guess is most people will eventually, but, you know, the shock will come to different people at different times. I think part of the problem is the definition of intellect, and, you know, we're using these terms intellect, consciousness, soul, and spirit, and so on. And, you know, as you know, there's a debate about what the meaning of those terms is. And I was trying to use the term intellect in a very narrow way, which mm-hmm. is why I gave the definition of the disembodied intellectual, you know, who, like the greedy person, also does have an emotional dimension. However, they try to live their life as if they didn't.
Right.
You know, you can't escape, a human being cannot escape their emotions, but they can pervert them, and they can channel them in ways that are not at all healthy. and or they can simply try to suppress them, which you can't do either, which is what leads to perversion and distortion. And
exactly.
Right.
Now, this is a great conversation, and I want to continue this conversation. I need to take a break of about a minute and a half. Can you hang about for a minute and a half?
I'm running out of coins. I'm calling you from a machine.
Oh, bummer.
So
all right.
I can call you back in a few minutes if you
all
want.
All right. That'd be great, because I'd love to continue this conversation.
Really?
Yes, I would. This is a good one.
Okay.
All right.
I'll call back.
All right.
Bye.
Sounds very surprised. Actually, I'm always happy to hear from my listeners, and if you want to throw your two cents worth in, please feel free to 518-276-6248. Little Brother will resume in a minute.
Things are good, nothing much for me to say.
WRPI Troy would like to apologize to the following groups and individuals. First, to that poor man we made implode on 7th Street the other day. How are we to know that would happen? Second, to all the faces on Mount Rushmore. Third, to the entirety of the United States Congress. Make that the entirety of the United States government. In fact, make that all governments and corporations everywhere. That should keep us clear. Everything is fine and good. We'd like to apologize to the collector who lives down the hall because we haven't given him enough junk recently. We'd like to apologize to the people who keep building spaceships and we keep telling them not to. We'd like to apologize to all the artists we've ever slighted, and to all those who we haven't slighted because we don't want anyone to know you exist. Sorry, you're really that bad. We'd like to apologize to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, West, because we haven't played enough weird music yet. But don't worry, it's coming up right now on WRPI Troy.
Since the cart said that we're going to play some weird music, we'll just let this run for a moment. And you are listening to 91.5 FM, WRPI Troy. The show is Little Brother.
Wow, that was a minute and a half?
That was actually a couple minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That was like the shortest minute and a half ever.
Steve has just arrived, so it sounds like Blender is going to be on tonight following the show. And he's nodding his head, so yep. Let's see here. So that'll be coming up at 7 o'clock. Okay, let's just throw in another item from the Risks Digest. This comes from Walsh Michael, and this is also continue on the BMI iDrive issue. He says, in my case, the problem was based on my experience with an early version of one of their intelligent cars, a 1986 520 injection that I was still using in 2001. When BMW transferred in connection with the Rover disaster their dealership in Finland to a different company, they lost all expertise amongst their mechanics of the era before computer-based maintenance. This led to such funnies as my car refusing to start once in the middle of a summer after a break of about 10 minutes in use. Then, me getting into it to start after a couple of hours of leaving it alone and taking it to the dealership only to be told that by starting it, it meant that they were unable to download the details of why it went wrong. Now, what should I have done? Bring it immediately next time the same thing happens, of course. So I pointed out that this meant waiting to be stranded and getting a tow truck. Yes, they replied. The very next day, that did in fact happen, and I was towed all the way to the BMW dealership, who then discovered that my model didn't have this download functionality as it was too old. Now you can perhaps see why relying on a BMW's intelligence is not exactly appealing. A further funny with the BMW that he bought in Germany to enable me to pre-warm the car before using it had an ability, this extra. You set a clock in the car to the time that this pre-warming should start, using gasoline from the tank, and it warms the motor and the inside of the car until you get into it. This worked perfectly when the temperature was around zero. This, of course, would be 0 degrees centigrade, which is 32 Fahrenheit. But at a few degrees less, it refused to click into action. Not much use in Finland, then. On the other hand, when the temperature was around 25 degrees centigrade, that would be somewhere in the lower 80s Fahrenheit, it did, in fact, jump into operation when you were driving along and were in desperate need of more heat. Not. And we have another addition on this one from Achim Nolkenlose, who writes that Volkswagen has also thrown prudence to the winds in its rush to adopt high technology. He says, we bought a 2002 VW Golf earlier this year, and within a week, the alarm system malfunctioned. The first symptom was the unprovoked appearance of the open door icon on the dash. The next symptom was the sounding of the alarm every time after locking the car in the normal manner, that is, by clicking the remote or turning the key in the driver's lock. The only way to prevent the alarm from going off was to lock the car manually, a procedure that the misplaced confidence of the car's designers had made fiendishly difficult. First, close the driver's door, then lock all doors with the remote, then unlock the driver's door with the remote and open it. Reach back to the rear door, unlock it with the handle latch, close the driver's door, open the rear door, reach forward from the rear and lock the front door by pressing the mechanical lock button, press the mechanical lock button on the rear door, and close it. This is the only way to lock the car without arming the alarm. Of course, the problem was intermittent, and the designers had not provided any diagnostics for the system, so on my first trip in to get the problem fixed, the dealership was completely unable to identify it or solve it. The solution had to wait until the problem had escalated to the point where the hatchback could not be opened in any manner, and there's no purely mechanical way to operate the hatchback latch. At this point, the technician's suspicion fell on the lock mechanism of the hatchback, which they then replaced, apparently fixing the problem. The potential problems are actually worse than what appears from this example, as the car has only two key locks, the one in the driver's door and the one in the hatchback. The hatchback lock, when it's working, can only be operated by the battery-operated master key. The valet key won't let you work on it. So it would seem that if you have only the valet key and the driver's lock jams, there's no way to get into the car other than breaking a window. Volkswagen supplies two of the master keys with each vehicle, and of these, the battery of one died in the first month. You are allowed to buy only up to two more, and they cost more than $200 a piece. What's wrong with that picture, I ask you? Got a caller on the line. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, I'm back.
Hey, welcome back.
Thank you.
So
good to be back.
Where were we? Where were we when we left off on this conversation?
You were saying how much you were enjoying it.
Okay. Before that,
he's quick.
And I don't know. I think we were sort of spinning our wheels a little bit, so maybe I could throw in. Well, I guess I was talking about how intellectuals. Are all about trying to suppress feeling in order to arrive at the utmost impartiality, so to speak, the utmost in order to free the logical faculty. In order to free the logical faculties, which is to say the intellect, you have to somehow lay your emotions aside. You know, you hear this all the time. Let's try to calm down, chill out, cool off, and just look at this
rationally.
Take a hard look at this. In other words, an intellectual look, right? Just leave our emotions aside. Which, of course, is aside from being, I think the whole idea of that is perverted. To ask people to leave their emotions aside is not only impossible, but it instantly perverts the discussion.
Well, I have 2 points that I would want to make on that. First, was your you had brought up the idea of Mr. Spock, or pick any other Vulcan from anywhere in the Star Trek universe, and the, you've got a you're provided with a perfect example. They are perfectly cold, perfectly rational, perfectly emotion free beings.
That's right.
Except when they're mating.
Well, nobody can be rational all the time.
There you do actually bring up a very valid point, Phil.
Yeah, I think they all get it all out of their system then.
But
but also Spock was the one that did the heroic like saving of the entire ship by going into the nuclear whatever the heck and
yeah,
effectively
but he'd been...
Hey, the good of the many outweighs the good of the one.
But he was hanging around humans for how many years at that point?
Yeah.
Well, exactly.
I mean,
he didn't get that from humans. He got that from you know, Vulcan ideology.
Well, you have wait a minute now. You have to
yes.
You have to get you know something straight about Spock. He was a Hollywood character, all right?
Absolutely.
Now, obviously, you know he's an interesting quasi example of what we're talking about in terms of a disembodied logician. However.
I'm sorry. We were raised by a Trekkie.
He had to have something about him that was appealing, and so if you really think about it,
well, he had that one.
The Vulcans had largely suppressed their emotional side, but he hadn't entirely suppressed it. He was clearly loyal. He clearly had feeling for his shipmates. He was, you know, he had undying loyalty, which can only come, as far as I'm concerned, from being emotionally connected. So, I think, you know, it's clear that all the Vulcans had done is they were able to achieve a relationship between their intellect and their emotion that was different, but they didn't annihilate their emotions. They didn't rip them out or just make them disappear. They still had them. But they simply had a different relationship to them, which I think is an interesting proposition, but it's not really what I'm talking about.
Right, absolutely.
I'm talking about people really trying to do something else. That is to say, Spock and the Vulcans, you know, really were pursuing the intellectual skill in a tireless way, whereas the average American, for example, and they are, while they also try not to feel things, they're taught to not feel things deeply, they are at the same time not tirelessly pursuing intellectual excellence. They are pursuing mediocrity.
Uh-huh.
They are pursuing them all.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm afraid you're right about that one. One of the things that inspired me to come on the air in the first place and do this show is that we are one seriously screwed up society, if not the entire race.
Yeah, well, I don't want to blame society as a whole. I think it's the people at the top that are you know orchestrating this. I don't mean necessarily conspiratorially, but. You know, I think it's the ones...
No, I don't think it's a conspiracy at all. It's more of a common goal.
Well,
you follow what I'm saying?
I'm sorry. They were asking for money and you got... you got obscured. What was it you were saying?
I said I don't think it's a conspiracy at all. It's more sort of a common goal.
Yeah, for everybody to make their buck, and everybody that's not making their buck to enjoy as much as they can while they're here.
Yeah, well, I would have to agree with you. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but let's face it, if we live in a society that is not a democracy, and the United States is manifestly not a democracy, then what else can it be but the results of endless conspiracies, and, you know, what they all boil down to, you know, is a whole other discussion, but it's very clear from Iran-Contra to COINTELPRO to the last presidential election you know, to the invasion of Afghanistan, which was planned last summer. It's coming out now. So, you know, that conspiracy, well, Enron, you know, and right. on and on and on and on. The Catholic Church and child molestation. You know, the conspiracies are all over the place.
Right.
And it's inevitable. If you don't have a democratic society, it doesn't mean people are going to start thinking and planning. They're just going to do it secretly.
Okay. Well, I'm going to let you go at this point so you don't have to drop any more coins in the phone. And we do have another caller on the line. But I thank you for calling, and I thank you very much for listening.
Okay. Bye.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi. Oh,
hi.
I'm on the air?
Yes, sir.
Now call back later, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Well, so much for that idea.
So much for the other caller.
Well, let me see. What else have we got that we can toss out here? Did you have any more over there that looked interesting?
Not really. Nothing that I knew about. Video voyeurism becoming a federal crime.
Yeah. Here, let me see that one. I'll sum it up real quick here.
Yeah, because it's a long one.
Yeah. And what we have here is a press release from Senator Landrieu of Louisiana. And basically what she's working on right now is a bill that I thought was kind of interesting. It makes illegal video voyeurism. And one of the things that was not really overwhelmingly well known is that it is not illegal to videotape your neighbor. Now, of course, I am not a lawyer.
Creeps the hell out of me.
It is creepy. It's very creepy. In fact, I want to say,
because I've had
sound,
some creepy
right?
neighbors.
No, video.
Yeah, but only if you record sound is it illegal.
Oh, I don't
it's
know.
It's like under wiretapping or something?
That might be true. I'm not sure. But I know there have been cases, I wish I had time to do the proper research on this one. But I'll sum it up really quickly. Basically, there have been cases where somebody has videotaped their neighbor acting in a manner that is perfectly appropriate within the confines of your own home. And then turned around and sued the neighbor that got videotaped.
Why?
How? For doing
yeah,
what?
Yeah, exactly. I see two shocked looks, which is exactly the effect I was going for. And I'm hoping that if I had been out there and was able to see the faces of the rest of my audience, that we would see similar shocked looks. Because it's wrong. It is shocking.
Explain it now.
The essence of it was that the neighbor was suing these people for exposing themselves in public.
How dare you let me videotape you naked and then make me watch it?
Right, exactly. Anyway.
Now, if you're in your own house...
Oh, the guy in the CD room's losing it. I hope it's not on my side.
Right. If you're in your own house and you're just walking around naked...
Right.
And you don't have any curtains up, and people can just see you walking around naked in your own home. You have the right to do that, don't you?
One would think so. You know,
why
it,
one would want
be.
To? I don't know.
I want to get a
one
house.
One should generally avoid doing such things, but
I want to build a house of glass and just walk around naked.
You know, I think in one of these cases, there was even a case of the neighbor cutting a hedgerow in order to be able to see into the neighbor's house.
Wow.
I'll have to get more detail on that one. It's worth exploring. Anyway, I don't know. Here's an interesting one here. This one was submitted to the Risks Digest by Dan Birchall, who has a really interesting email address, which I will only give because of the fact that it is a spam proofing email address. His email address is icharge100bucks per spam@nospam.insert-his-domain-here.com. And he says, as a longtime spam fighter, I've learned to be a little careful about who gets my various email addresses. If I would let somebody call me collect, maybe they don't really deserve my personal email address either. As a longtime human, I make mistakes. A few months back, for example, I submitted a piece to the Risks Digest from my personal email address. Oops. Now it's available on the web at no fewer than 8 URLs. Now, so far, it's only gotten me one piece of spam. I'll just hope that the other spammers and address scaping bots are smart enough not to scrape addresses from a risks archive.
Hmm.
Hmm. Yeah. And that makes me wonder, because I do get a heck of a lot of spam, and I've submitted things here to the Risks Digest a number of times, so...
Now, if someone sends you spam, you can legally go after them and collect money?
It depends on where you are. You certainly have a right to send a bill. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with sending somebody a bill. Now, whether or not they decide to pay it and whether or not it's collectible if they don't pay it, those are matters that vary from state to state at the present time.
What is the law like in New York? Is it like $500 or?
I don't think there is one in New York. Now, I know Washington State, yeah, you can charge $500 for it, plus other various things that you can tack on to jack it up if you want. You know, you can trump that puppy up as high as you want. Or more accurately, you can trump that puppy up as high as your lawyer's creativity. You know, and that's, I don't know. Depends on who you hire for a lawyer, I guess. Let's see here. Item from Monty Solomon. He says, watch out. The spam choking your email inbox may be loaded with software that lets marketers track your moves online, and you may not even be aware that you've been bugged. Websites have long planted bits of code called cookies on consumers' hard drives to tailor internet pages for returning visitors and better target ads. Now, enhanced messages that share the look and feel of web pages are being used to deliver the same bits of code through email, in many cases without regard for safeguards that have been developed to protect consumer privacy on the web. All the security and privacy issues on the web relate to email, said Adam Shostak, director of technology at Zero Knowledge Systems, a Montreal-based privacy and security company. The shame about this behavior is it's going on surreptitiously, and people are not given an obvious way to opt out. Actually, I can think of a few ways to opt out, but...
It's you know, what I do is Internet Explorer has everything disabled. Java, ActiveX, everything's disabled, and I use that...
Yeah, but this is email.
Yeah, well, email, like Outlook Express goes through Internet Explorer.
Oh.
Anyway, so Internet Explorer has all this stuff disabled, and I use Netscape that has everything enabled for sites I trust. You just go into your security settings and just disable all that junk.
Right, right.
Now, you're not going to be able to visit every single website because...
Yeah, that's a pain.
Some require you to have Java and cookies enabled, but on sites I trust, I'll use Netscape, and on sites I'm not familiar with or don't trust, I use Internet Explorer.
See, that's exactly the opposite attack I would have taken if Internet Explorer was even offered to Linux users, but I like Mozilla.
It's, yeah, I mean, that has a nice look and feel to it.
It's, unfortunately, it's not quite a mature product yet. And it's still got a handful of bugs in it. At any rate, I think we ought to be getting close to the point of wrapping this one up. And so, let me see here. You want to pick a tune off of here
I'm trying to think of one that's like clean.
Yeah, I know.
Do the first one, track number one.
We played that last time. But yeah,
no, we didn't, did we?
Yeah, we did.
Oh. I don't remember that.
Track one, Tim Maloney, Thunderclock is the name of the song.
All right, here goes. This is another item from the Droplift Project, and we're wrapping up another episode of Little Brother.
And good night.
And good night.
how's this place kept functioning by the primitive minds we've met?
For you, Rye is nothing. But for us, Roy, just like my father and mother.
What can I do for you, sir?
This fried rice stinks.
Oh, yeah? No problem. You don't like my rice? You don't like my rice? What's wrong with the food? It is beautiful for me. What's wrong with the food?
This fried rice stinks.
What's wrong with the food?
This fried rice stinks.
It is beautiful for me.